Okay, so picture this. You're on your shift. You walk into a patient's room, and it's 3 hours post-op. It was a kidney stone removal, should have been routine, but something is just, it's really wrong.
You feel it in your gut.
Yeah. The patient's suddenly confused, they're restless, and their BP is just trending down fast. It's gone from 120 over 80 to 95 over 60,
And the heart rate.
spiking. It's at 115. You have like seconds to figure this out. What is your number one immediate priority concern?
And that scenario right there,
Yeah.
that is the entire point of the NCLEX.
Right.
It's testing your ability to see that deterioration before it becomes a catastrophe. I'm talking about shock, maybe sepsis, maybe a hemorrhage.
It's all happening at once.
Exactly. And our mission today is to give you that high-yield roadmap. We're going to help you reduce that risk potential and grab those crucial priority points on the exam.
Welcome back to ConceptCast. We're your study tool from Nursing Notes, and we know exactly how much you have to master for the NCLEX.
We do. But the exam blueprint is pretty clear. You know,
Well,
it
yeah.
really hammers on safety.
Which means knowing how to prevent or manage complications.
That's right. So today we are doing a deep dive into physiological integrity and specifically the reduction of risk potential. It's a huge piece of the test.
Huge.
We're going to cover the most critical stuff. We'll start with pre-op safety checks, then immediate post-op crisis management, and then spotting those huge red flags.
MI, stroke, sepsis, shock,
Right.
the big
The
ones.
big ones. And of course, the high-yield labs and diagnostics, they always test you on. We're going beyond just memorizing. We're getting to the clinical why.
Think of this as your focused study session. We're going to move fast, but we're going to be thorough. You ready to unpack this?
Let's do it. Okay, so preparation, it's really half the battle. And the NCLEX loves, and I mean loves, to test the nurse's specific role in that pre-op phase.
It's all about preventing problems before they even start.
Exactly.
So step one, the foundation of it all, is getting that good baseline data. Vitals, labs, maybe a pre-op EKG. But why? Why is that baseline so important if the patient seems totally fine?
It's all about having something to compare to. It's your yardstick for what happens after surgery.
Okay.
So let's say a patient's hemoglobin is 15 before surgery and it drops to 12 after. That 3-point drop is a big deal. It could mean they're bleeding somewhere.
Right.
But what if their baseline was already 12 because they have chronic anemia? Then a post-op result of 12 is, well, it's not a change, it's their normal. Without the baseline, you have no context.
So in that baseline lab panel, what are we really zeroing in on?
Well, you're screening for anemia for sure, because that affects oxygen carrying capacity.
Right.
But the most critical lab, I would argue, is electrolytes,
Potassium.
especially potassium.
Yeah.
Any pre-existing hypo or hyperkalemia, it dramatically increases the risk for a life-threatening dysrhythmia when they're under anesthesia. It's our job to spot that and make sure the surgeon knows before the case starts.
Okay, let's talk about the classic consent trap. This pops up all the time in priority questions. The nurse's role versus the provider's role, where's the line?
It's a perfect example of how the NCLEX tests your understanding of legal scope of practice. The nurse's role is, well, it's really just administrative and advocacy.
So you're not doing the explaining.
No, you're witnessing the signature, you're confirming the patient seems competent, that they're signing it voluntarily. That's it.
So what if the patient turns to you and says, "Hey, I get it, but can you just explain that part about the recovery time again?"
That's the trap
That's it.
right there.
Yeah.
The second they ask a clarifying question about the procedure itself, the risks, the steps, the outcome,
Ugh.
you have to stop everything.
And call the provider back.
You call the provider back to the bedside. The surgeon is responsible for that detailed explanation. Your job as the patient's advocate is to make sure their consent is truly informed. Otherwise, it's not valid.
All right, moving on to MPO status. This is a huge safety issue. It's all about preventing aspiration.
Which is just devastating. I mean, especially when the patient's gag reflex is gone under anesthesia,
Right.
the timing here is a really common test point.
So what are the rules?
Okay, so the standard is usually 6 to 8 hours for any solids or, non-clear liquids like milk.
But there's a nuanced state test, right?
There is. For clear liquids, and we're talking water, black coffee, apple juice, the requirement is often only 2 hours before the procedure.
So why the difference? Why not just make everything 8 hours to be safe?
It's all about gastric emptying times. Clear liquids move through the stomach much, much faster.
Ah, okay.
So by allowing them up to 2 hours before, we reduce that aspiration risk, but we also keep the patient from being dehydrated or hypoglycemic from fasting for too long. It's a risk balance thing.
Let's hit medication adjustments. Holding certain meds before surgery is super high yield because of the risks. What are the big categories?
Three big ones to know. First, obviously, anticoagulants. Warfarin, heparin, they're a massive bleeding risk, almost always held.
Okay, makes sense.
Second, some antihypertensives. Anesthesia already causes vasodilation, which lowers blood pressure.
So you could double down on the hypotension.
Exactly. You could get this dangerous refractory hypotension that's hard to treat. The provider has to give clear orders on holding those.
And the third one is critical for our diabetic patients.
Insulin and oral hypoglycemics.
Yeah.
The patient's MPO, so giving their standard dose, is a recipe for severe hypoglycemia.
A huge risk.
So the dose has to be adjusted. Maybe they get a fraction of their long-acting or they're put on an IV drip. And your job is to check that blood glucose frequently. It's a constant balancing act.
Okay, last pre-op point. Prophylactic antibiotics. Preventing surgical site infections.
Timing is everything here. You have to get that antibiotic to a high concentration in the tissue right when the incision is made.
So what's the window?
The nurse has to make sure that IV dose is infused and finished about 30 to 60 minutes before the first cut.
And if you give it too early?
Too early, like 4 hours before, and the drug level falls off. Too late, like after the incision, and the bacteria are already in there. It's all about that precise timing.
All right, patient's out of surgery. They're in the PEEP ICU. Now priorities shift completely. It's all about stabilization, and the ABCs are everything.
Oh, absolutely. The risks are huge right now. You've got leftover anesthesia, potential blood loss, no reflexes.
Let's break down that ABC framework in this specific context. A is for airway.
Airway and breathing are paramount. First, is it patent?
Yeah.
The most common problem right out of surgery is the tongue relaxing and blocking the airway.
A simple fix sometimes.
Often, yeah. A simple jaw thrust might be all you need. But you're monitoring O2 sats, rate, depth, rhythm. You're listening to breath sounds. And if you see accessory muscle use, that's a sign of impending respiratory failure.
And C, circulation. This brings us back to our opening scenario.
It does. Falling BP, rising heart rate. That's the textbook sign of early hypovolemic shock. It's probably a hemorrhage.
So what do you do?
You're checking pulses, BP, skin color, temperature.
Yeah.
You're looking for bleeding. You're checking the dressing, the drains. You're even rolling the patient to check for blood pooling underneath them. You have to figure out if it's a bleed or just leftover vasodilation from the anesthesia, and you have to do it fast.
Right after ABCs, we have to talk about pain management. And it's not just for comfort, right? It's a safety issue.
It's absolutely a safety intervention.
Yeah.
Severe, uncontrolled pain is physiologically harmful.
How so?
A patient in a lot of pain, especially in their chest or belly, they're going to splint. They'll take these tiny, shallow breaths.
Which leads right to atelectasis.
Directly. So you have to give those IV analgesics promptly.
Yeah.
But you're also watching their respirations to make sure you're not over-sedating them. It's another balancing act.
Okay. The patient is stable. They've moved to the surgical floor. Now the focus shifts again. It's about preventing those common but still deadly post-op complications.
Right. And the NCLEX loves to ask for the single best intervention. The theme here is simple. Mobilization.
Get them moving.
Get them moving.
Yeah. Let's start with respiratory. We're trying to prevent atelectasis and pneumonia.
The cornerstone is actively opening those alveoli. And that means incentive spirometry, deep breathing, and coughing.
The trifecta.
It is. You teach them pre-op, and you make sure they're doing it post-op. A slow, deep breath in, hold it, and repeat that 10 times an hour while they're awake. It's simple, but it's incredibly effective.
Next up, cardiovascular risks. DVT, and the thing we're really scared of, a PE.
This is probably the most high-yield post-op topic you'll find. The enemy is stasis blood, just sitting in the veins.
So we use SCDs, TED hose.
Yep, ankle pumps, maybe some prophylactic anticoagulants. But the single best intervention, the one that helps with everything, respiratory, GI, and DVT prevention, is early ambulation.
That's the gold standard answer on the test, isn't it?
It is, almost always.
Yeah.
Getting those calf muscles moving is what pushes that venous blood back to the heart and stops clots from forming.
Hmm.
If you get a question about a post-op patient refusing to get out of bed, your primary concern is DVT and atelectasis.
And finally, GI and urinary function. We need to make sure everything's waking back up.
Anesthesia really slows down the gut. So the key assessment, before you advance their diet past clear liquids, is listening for bowel sounds.
In all four quadrants.
All four. And ideally, you want to confirm they've passed gas. If you advance the diet too soon, you're looking at nausea, vomiting, maybe even a paralytic ileus.
And for urinary output.
We're tracking it religiously. You need to watch for urinary retention. And the hard and fast rule you have to know is less than 30 millimeters of urine per hour for 2 straight hours.
That's a problem.
That's a huge problem. It signals poor kidney perfusion, and you have to report it immediately.
All right, let's shift gears from preventing complications to responding to a full-blown crisis. This is about spotting the deteriorating patient before they actually crash.
This is the essence of good clinical nursing. We're going to focus on the big four.
Yeah.
Sepsis, shock, MI, and stroke.
Let's start with sepsis. It's so time-sensitive.
It is. And it's not just an infection, right? It's the body's overwhelming, dysregulated response to an infection that causes organ dysfunction. Time is tissue.
So what are those early signs, the red flags that tell you this isn't just a simple infection anymore?
You're looking for systemic inflammation and poor perfusion. So changes in temperature, either a fever or, sometimes even worse, hypothermia. That's a really bad sign.
Okay.
Then you see the cardiovascular distress, a fast heart rate, so tachycardia and dropping blood pressure, hypotension. And often, one of the very first signs is a change in mental status. New confusion, restlessness.
And then the organs start to show it.
Exactly. You get tachypnea, so they're breathing fast to blow off acid, and their urine output starts to drop.
When you see those signs line up, the sequence of actions is absolutely critical for the test.
Non-negotiable. This is the big NCLEX point. You must obtain blood cultures before you start the broad-spectrum IV antibiotics.
Why is that so important?
Because the antibiotics will basically sterilize the blood. Your cultures will come back negative, and you'll never know what specific bug you're fighting.
So you can't tailor the treatment later.
Right. So you get the cultures, ideally from 2 different sites, and then right away, you hang that first dose of antibiotics.
And after that, you're focusing on support.
Aggressive fluid resuscitation. Big volumes of IV crystalloids to fill up those dilated blood vessels. You give them oxygen, and you monitor their lactate level.
Why lactate?
High lactate is basically the chemical signature of tissue hypoxia. Tells you the cells aren't getting enough oxygen and the patient is in serious trouble.
Okay, let's talk about shock, the fundamental failure of the circulatory system.
No matter what causes it, the result at the cellular level is the same, hypoxia and damage. You can think of it as a problem with the tank, the pump, or the pipes.
I like that analogy. So hypovolemic shock.
The tank is empty, not enough volume. So hemorrhage, severe dehydration.
Cardiogenic shock.
The pump is broken. A massive heart attack, severe heart failure. The heart just can't pump effectively.
And distributive shock.
The pipes are too wide. Massive vasodilation. Sepsis is the most common cause, but also anaphylaxis or a spinal cord injury.
But no matter the cause, are there universal early signs of shock that we should be looking for?
Yes. The body's compensation is pretty predictable. You're going to see tachycardia, a fast heart rate, as the body tries to keep up.
And hypotension.
And hypotension, that's the defining feature. Blood gets shunted to the core, so you get cool, clammy skin, weak peripheral pulses. The brain gets irritable, so you see restlessness or anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And the kidneys start to fail, so you see that critically low urine output, less than 0.5 millibill per kilogram per hour.
Treatment is about fixing the cause, but there's a huge distinction the test will hit you with. When do you not give a ton of IV fluids?
This is a really high-level point. Fluids are the answer for hypovolemic and distributive shock.
Okay.
But if the problem is cardiogenic shock...
The pump is already broken.
The pump is broken. If you pour more fluid into a failing pump, you're just going to flood the system. You'll overload the heart, back fluid up into the lungs, and make everything much, much worse.
So for cardiogenic shock, the treatment is different.
Completely. You're focused on supporting the pump with medications, not just filling the tank. Knowing the distinction is critical.
All right, let's move on to myocardial infarction, MI.
Time is muscle here. And MI is heart muscle death from a lack of oxygen. The classic signs are that crushing chest pain, maybe radiating to the arm or jaw, not relieved by rest.
Mm.
But the NCLEX loves to test the atypical presentations.
Okay, so who are we worried about for atypical symptoms?
You have to remember 3 groups, women, the elderly, and diabetics.
And what do they present with instead of chest pain?
It can be really subtle, extreme, sudden fatigue. Shortness of breath is their only symptom. Sometimes it just feels like bad indigestion or heartburn. If you have a patient with cardiac risk factors who suddenly feels exhausted or has heartburn, you have to work them up for an MI.
Okay. The emergency care mnemonic is MONA. Can you break that down?
Sure. M is for morphine, for pain, and to reduce the heart's oxygen demand. O is for oxygen, if they're hypoxic. N is for nitrates, to dilate the coronary arteries. And A is for aspirin.
And which of those is the absolute first priority?
Aspirin, a chewable aspirin specifically.
Why chewables?
For rapid absorption through the mouth, it gets to work immediately to stop platelets from clumping together and making the clot bigger. It's the first thing you do.
And how do we confirm the diagnosis?
Two things, a 12-lead ECG and cardiac enzymes. On the ECG, you're looking for ST segment elevation, a STEMI. That means a full thickness injury, and they need to go to the cath lab right now.
And the enzymes.
We're looking at troponin. Elevated troponin confirms that heart muscle has died.
Yeah.
But here's a key point. If you see a STEMI on the ECG, you don't wait for the troponin results to come back.
You act on the ECG.
You act on the ECG. The ECG tells you it's an emergency. The labs just confirm what you already know. Time is muscle.
Last one in this section, stroke or CVA, time is brain.
Absolutely. The assessment tool you have to know cold for the NCLEX is the FAST mnemonic.
Okay, let's run through it. F is for?
Face drooping. Ask them to smile, and one side will droop.
A is for?
Arm weakness. Have them hold both arms out. One will drift down. Speech difficulty. Slurred speech, or they can't find the right words.
Any T.
Time. Time to note when the symptoms started and time to call for help immediately.
So once you suspect a stroke, what is the absolute number one management priority?
Get a stat CT scan of the head.
Yeah.
Immediately.
It overrides everything else.
Almost everything except, you know, basic airway management. The whole point of that CT scan is to differentiate. You have to know if it's an ischemic stroke, which is a clot, or a hemorrhagic stroke, which is a bleed.
And why is that the critical first step?
Because the treatment for an ischemic stroke is a powerful clot-busting drug called TPA. If you give TPA to someone who is having a hemorrhagic stroke, a bleed, you will kill them. You'll turn a small bleed into a catastrophic hemorrhage. The CT is the only way to rule out a bleed, and you have to do it before you can even think about treatment.
All right, let's get into the numbers game with lab values. These are so important.
They are. And for the NCLEX, you have to connect the abnormal value to the immediate system at risk.
Let's start with sodium. Normal is 135 to 145.
Right. And when you see an abnormal sodium, high or low, you need to immediately think neuro changes.
Seizure risk.
A huge seizure risk. Low sodium causes brain cells to swell. High sodium causes them to shrink. Both can cause confusion, agitation, and seizures. So your priority nursing action is to initiate seizure precautions.
Okay. Now the big one for the heart, potassium. Normal is 3.5 to 5.0.
Yep. And any deviation from that, high or low, means immediate cardiac instability.
So cardiac monitor.
Instantly. You have to get them on a cardiac monitor. Hypokalemia can cause arrhythmias, and hyperkalemia can cause those classic PHT waves and lead to fatal arrhythmias like VFib.
Is there a critical value for potassium they love to test?
Anything over 6.0 is an emergency. It requires rapid, immediate intervention. But here's another connection they might test. Severe hypokalemia, so really low potassium, can also paralyze the smooth muscle in your gut.
Leading to a paralytic ileus.
Exactly. It's a connection a lot of people forget, but it's a classic test point.
And let's briefly touch on calcium. Normal is 8.5 to 10.5.
Calcium is all about neuromuscular excitability. So low calcium hypocalcemia leads to tetany, muscle spasms. You get those classic Shavostix and Trousseau signs.
And high calcium?
Hypercalcemia does the opposite. It causes muscle weakness, lethargy, and fatigue.
Okay, arterial blood gases, ABGs. Let's use the Rome method to break it down. Respiratory opposite, metabolic equal.
Yes, but let's go a step further and talk about compensation because that's the advanced skill they're testing.
Okay, so respiratory acidosis.
Low pH, high CO2. It's opposite. The cause is always hypoventilation.
Mm-hmm.
The patient isn't blowing off enough CO2. Think COPD and overdose.
Respiratory alkalosis.
IPH, low CO2. Again, opposite. Cause is hyperventilation. Anxiety, pain. They're blowing off too much CO2.
Metabolic acidosis.
Low pH, low bicarb. They're equal. Classic causes are DKA, renal failure, severe diarrhea.
And metabolic alkalosis.
High pH, high bicarb. Equal again?
Mm.
Usually caused by losing acid, like from severe vomiting or too many antacids.
So how does compensation fit in? How do we spot that on the test?
So the body always tries to fix the problem. If it's a respiratory problem, the kidneys, the metabolic system, will try to compensate. And vice versa.
And we look at all three values to see if it's working.
Exactly. If the compensating value is also abnormal, compensation is started. If the pH is still abnormal, it's partially compensated.
And if the pH is back to normal?
If the pH is back in that 7.35 to 7.45 range, but the CO2 and bicarb are still out of whack, it's fully compensated. It means the body has fixed the immediate problem, and it's usually a sign of a chronic condition.
All right, coagulation studies. Managing anticoagulants is so high risk, so this is always on the test. Let's start with warfarin.
For warfarin, or Coumadin, you're monitoring the PT and, more specifically, the INR.
And what's the therapeutic range we need to know?
Normal INR is about 1. For a patient on warfarin, the therapeutic range is typically 2.0 to 3.0. Anything over 4.0 is getting into the danger zone and needs to be addressed.
And for 5-E-heparin?
For heparin, you're looking at the APTT. And the therapeutic goal is usually 1.5 to 2.5 times the normal control value.
And if it's too high?
If the APTT is too high, the bleeding risk is critical. The nurse has to stop the infusion immediately and notify the provider.
And we can't forget platelets.
Right. A low platelet count, thrombocytopenia, also increases bleeding risk. So if it's below 150,000, you're being careful. If it's critically low, like under 50,000, that patient is on strict bleeding precautions.
Okay, wrapping up the core content with diagnostics. Patient safety before these big imaging tests is a huge nursing responsibility.
It really is.
Let's start with MRI versus CT scan. For an MRI, what's the absolute contraindication?
It's all about the giant magnet. So the absolute contraindication is any kind of ferromagnetic metal implant, a pacemaker, an aneurysm clip, cochlear implants.
And the nurse's job?
It's a screen. You have to ask about every surgery, every possible metal implant, and make sure all external metal is removed. It's a huge safety risk.
Now, for the CT scan, especially with contrast dye, what's the risk there?
The risk is chemical, not mechanical. The big one is contrast-induced nephropathy. That iodine-based dye is tough on the kidneys.
It's nephrotoxic.
Very. So the mandatory nursing safety check is to look at their kidney function first. Check their BUN and creatinine.
And if their kidneys are already weak?
Then they can't clear the dye, and you risk putting them into acute kidney injury. You have to advocate for them. And you also check for allergies to iodine or shellfish. And you make sure they're well hydrated before and after to help flush that dye out.
And finally, the EKG. For the acute patient, what are we watching for?
You're watching that ST segment.
Yeah.
ST elevation means acute injury, a STEMI. ST depression means ischemia, a lack of oxygen.
And the nursing role?
Is precision. You have to have proper electrode placement on clean, dry skin to get an accurate reading. And you're always monitoring the patient for symptoms that go along with what you're seeing on the screen.
All right. We've covered so much ground. Now it's time to see if it's sticking. We're going to do some rapid-fire checkpoints.
Let's do it.
I'll give you the scenario. Take just a second to think, and then we'll give you the answer. Ready?
Ready.
Checkpoint one. Your patient has suspected septic shock, hypotensive, tachycardic. You have the broad-spectrum antibiotics ready to go. What is the single absolute priority action you must perform first?
Take a second.
Think about it.
The answer is, obtain blood cultures first from two different sites. The rationale is, you have to identify the bug before you start killing it with antibiotics.
Checkpoint two. Your patient had an open appendectomy yesterday. They're refusing to use their incentive spirometer or get out of bed. They say it hurts too much, even with pain meds. What two major complications are you most concerned about right now?
Take a second.
What's at the top of your list?
The answer, a high risk of DVT and atelectasis leading to pneumonia. That immobility is causing venous stasis in the legs and shallow breathing in the lungs.
Checkpoint three, a patient's potassium level comes back at 6.2. You, correctly, put them on a cardiac monitor immediately. Besides the heart, what other major body system should you be assessing?
Think beyond the heart.
What else does potassium affect?
The answer is the neuromuscular system. Hyperkalemia causes muscle weakness and even paralysis. You need to be checking their strength and reflexes.
Checkpoint four. A 78-year-old female patient with diabetes reports only overwhelming fatigue and a little bit of nausea. No chest pain at all. Her ECG shows ST depression. What essential medication do you need to give her immediately?
This is that atypical presentation.
What's the priority med?
The answer is chewable aspirin. You have to recognize this as a potential MI and act on the signs of ischemia to stop that clot from getting bigger.
Last one, checkpoint five. Your patient is showing clear signs of a stroke, a positive FAST assessment. The STAT CT scan confirms it's ischemic, no bleed. What's the typical time limit for giving the clot buster TPA?
This is a critical window.
How much time do you have?
The answer is the window is typically within 3 to 4.5 hours from when the symptoms first started, which is why everything has to happen so fast. Okay, let's consolidate all of this. If you can master these three non-negotiable concepts, you're going to be in great shape for these priority questions on the NCLEX.
A negotiable one, pre- and post-op safety. You have to be the gatekeeper. Enforce those MPO rules. Remember the two-hour window for clear liquids.
And post-op, your number one intervention is almost always going to be early ambulation. It prevents so many problems. And don't forget that consent distinction. You witness, the provider explains.
Non-negotiable too, deterioration response. You have to have that instant recall. For sepsis, it's cultures before antibiotics, period. For shock, you recognize the signs, but you also know when not to give fluids, and that's in cardiogenic shock. And for stroke, it's fast, then stat CT to rule out a bleed before you can even think about TPA. Time is everything.
And non-negotiable three, critical labs. Know what the numbers mean for your patient's immediate safety.
Potassium abnormalities mean cardiac risk. Put them on the monitor. Sodium abnormalities mean neuro risk. Put them on seizure precautions. And for AVGs, go beyond just identifying the pattern. Understand compensation.
Master the why behind these priorities, and you'll approach the NCLEX with so much more confidence.
Absolutely.
Okay, if your head is spinning right now with all of these details, all these numbers and timeframes, that's completely normal.
It is. NCLEX prep is tough because it's not just about knowing facts, it's about applying them under pressure.
And that speed, that confidence,
yeah,
it comes from repetition and from really understanding the concepts. You have this knowledge now. It's just about making it stick.
And to help with that, remember that ConceptCast is brought to you by nursingnotes.org. We're a resource built by nurses who have been right where you are. We focus on cutting-edge ways to learn, including music-powered learning.
It's the first and only resource that actually uses music to help you memorize complex info, like lab values and drug side effects.
Plus, we have AI tools designed to make sure these concepts really do stick, so go check it out.
Now, we'll leave you with one final thought to mull over. It's designed to lock in that stroke priority.
Okay.
If a patient comes in with signs of an ischemic stroke, and you know that TPA clock is ticking, why is checking their fingerstick blood glucose considered an absolutely mandatory step, even before the CT scan? Think about the one condition that perfectly mimics a stroke, but is incredibly easy to reverse.
Go crush your studying. Focus on these safety concepts, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.